Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to episode 3 of ALS Crowd Radio. I'm your host, Seth Christensen, and here with my co-host, Amy Christensen. We're excited today to have Dr. Michael Weiss of the University of Washington with us. I'll have Amy introduce him.
Thank you. Dr. Weiss, Director of Neuromuscular Disease Division, is a UW professor, a University of Washington professor of neurology and adjunct professor in the Department of Rehabilitation Medicine. He sees patients at the University of Washington Medical Center. His clinic increases interests are including the diagnosis and treatments of neuromuscular diseases, including ALS, and a vast other neuromuscular diseases. Welcome to the show today, Dr. Weiss.
Well, thank you so much, Seth.
It is great to have you here today, and our listeners are excited to discuss ALS among other neurological disorders. I thought we would start off, Dr. Weiss, by asking our typical loaded question. What is ALS?
So ALS is a disorder that affects the nerves that arise in the brain and then in the spinal cord that send signals to muscles. And so there are two populations of so-called motor neurons that seem to undergo this degeneration. And as a consequence, over a period of time, the muscles begin to twitch and they shrink and then they become weak. And the muscles can be any muscles in the arms and the legs, the muscles of breathing and the muscles of speech and swallowing. Can any of those areas can be affected, and it's variable in how those areas are affected initially and over time. So what we don't know exactly is what triggers this disease. We have some ideas about that, and that's led to some therapy like riluzole, which is a glutamate blocker. So we think that there's a normal chemical in the nervous system called glutamate that there's too much of it. It's not cleared from the environment of the neurons by the supporting cells, the glial cells, and as a consequence, there's damage to the motor neurons, and over time, they die. And so that discovery a number of years ago led to the initiation and development of riluzole, which remains the only FDA-approved treatment for the disease, but unfortunately, it doesn't do nearly as much as we would like, and it only slows the disease down somewhat. So there are a lot of other areas that of interest that are being explored as potential causes of ALS, like so-called oxidative stress, whereby the byproduct of energy metabolism by these little energy factories of neurons and the motor neurons, mitochondria, cause damage to the neurons themselves because the byproducts of these oxygen-free radicals are not removed, and they damage the motor neurons. And then there are other ideas that we're exploring, like inflammation, activation of these inflammatory cells in the brain and the spinal cord called microglia, that they lead to a cascade of events that damage motor neurons. And then finally, I think another really interesting focus is about these proteins that deposit in the nuclear material the cells are, that is where the RNA originates, but further out in the so-called cytoplasm, we can see these proteins deposit, and there are different proteins, but they all seem to be very true, typical of ALS, but also of other degenerative diseases, and that's where ALS shares its similarity with other degenerative diseases where this happens as well. So my area of focus recently has been on another potential cause of ALS, and which is something called hyperexcitability. And there's evidence that in ALS in very early stage and looking at animal models of ALS and tissue culture models, that the neurons are overexcited, that they're overstimulated. And the thought is that that could potentially lead to premature death of neurons. And so if one thought would be, could we rescue viable neurons by suppressing this excitation with medicines that do that? And that, so I'm doing a study using the drug mexiletine, which is a sodium channel blocker, sodium being important for exciting neurons and having them send electricity or action potentials down to their processes, down to muscle. And so mexiletine, we think, is suppressing that. We're hoping it's going to suppress that. And that's in clinical trial right now. And we should hope to have the results of that study probably by the end of the year.
We love to hear about new studies. And if it would be okay, would like to talk about that a little more later on.
Sure.
One brief question. You mentioned two populations of motor neurons that are affected in ALS. Could you clarify what those are?
Yeah, so the two population of motor neurons are motor neurons that arise in the cortex of the brain, the higher part of the brain, and then they send their projections or axons down to the spinal cord, and then eventually they input or they interface with spinal motor neurons. That's the second population, or they're sometimes called anterior horn cells. And then those neurons send processes to the muscle. And the muscles start to shrink and become weak as those neurons die, because they require nutrients from those neurons via those axons, those projections, and that's what leads to the wasting of the muscle. And when they're damaged, that's what leads to the twitching of the muscle as well, and weakness, of course.
Now, we have heard our other guests mention upper and lower motor neurons. Are those synonyms here, or is that a different?
That's another way that they're categorized. So cortical motor neurons or upper motor neurons. And so when they're damaged, the typical manifestations are jumpy reflexes and stiffness, or increased muscle tone, incoordination, and weakness to some extent. But when the spinal motor neurons or the lower motor neurons are damaged, that's what leads to the wasting of the muscle and the twitching, as I mentioned. So that is another way to look at them, upper and lower motor neurons.
Great. Thank you for that clarification.
Sure.
Now, you began to mention that ALS has some commonality with other neurological disorders. I would like us to talk a bit about those other, distant or near cousins of ALS. What other diseases are in the same family?
Well, I think that diseases that are similar are ones that have similar defining pathology. And so one of those diseases, which also can coexist with ALS, is frontotemporal dementia. So that's a less, so we all hear about Alzheimer's dementia. Frontotemporal dementia is not an uncommon, but a less common form of dementia. And that is not characterized so much by memory changes early on, but rather behavioral changes where patients' behaviors seem to change, or sometimes they become paranoid or obsessive compulsive, or they lose the ability to project into the future. They might seem like they're depressed, but they're really just apathetic. It causes apathy. And sometimes it affects language. So they have difficulty not necessarily just slurring their words, but finding their words. So recent studies have suggested as many as 10% of patients with ALS actually have frontotemporal dementia as well, if you do some rigorous testing for it. And that, those are usually forms of their questionnaires that psychologists often administer. And we do a bedside test called the ALS Cognitive Behavioral Screen, which is a quick, sort of quicker screen that usually has to be corroborated with further testing to see if that's indeed the case. And then up to about probably another 40% of patients, so tall told 50% of all ALS patients, can have some more modest impairment of executive function, like being able to project in the future, plan, make decisions, or behavioral changes, or ability or language problems. So not to the degree that they would meet well-defined criteria for frontotemporal dementia. So what's common to both frontotemporal dementia and ALS, or sporadic ALS at least, that is, or at least not patients without SOD1 gene mutations, that form of familial ALS, is that there is a particular protein that seems to accumulate or aggregate in the outside the nucleus of neurons, both in frontotemporal dementia, not in motor neurons, but other neurons in the cortex, but also in ALS patients. And this is a protein called tRDNA binding protein 43. And so that's an important regulatory protein for the nuclear machinery, basically translating RNA into proteins. And so that should usually be in the nucleus of the cell, of these neurons. And every neuron, normally, we have TDP-43, but for some reason, it seems to leave the nucleus and go into the cytoplasm, and then it sort of clumps together. So, and that's true of both frontotemporal dementia, not motor neurons, but other neurons, and in ALS. And that's what makes those diseases sort of linked, and as well as the fact that ALS patients often have some element of frontotemporal dysfunction, if not frontotemporal dementia.
Great. So that is, we've heard from other guests of the interest in the connection between these two. What other diseases or disorders or syndromes are in the relative neighborhood of ALS?
So other diseases that are on the spectrum of ALS, so I tend to lump these together with classic Lou Gehrig's disease because I just think it's part of the same disorder. Diseases with patients with just pure lower motor neuron findings, and those are patients that have what's known as progressive muscular atrophy. And those patients don't have the jumpy reflexes or the stiffness because they don't have the upper motor neuron findings of classic Lou Gehrig's disease patients, but they do have the weakness, and they do get breathing issues because it affects the muscles that help them breathe, like the diaphragm. They don't usually get swallowing problems either. And it's a disease that tends to progress in a manner that's similar to ALS, but at a slower rate. And then other variants of ALS that I, again, think of as likely being on the same spectrum. There's something called progressive bulbar palsy, where patients just have speech and swallowing difficulties, but over time they usually develop ALS, the other features of ALS. And then there's a disease that just involves the upper motor neurons. And this disease, I think there's some controversy as to whether or not it really is on the same spectrum of ALS, and this is called primary lateral sclerosis. And those patients have a very, very long course, decades, and while they can get breathing issues and they can certainly get swallowing issues, the progression is extremely slow. So the variants of ALS tend to be much less common than ALS itself, certainly less than 5 or 10% for most of these disorders I mentioned. Now, other diseases that could look like ALS that are forms of motor neuron disease include a condition called spinal muscular atrophy. That's a disease that's typically inherited and presents in most patients in early life, in childhood or in infancy, and it can be quite lethal in when it presents very early in life. But occasionally in adults, there are patients that present, or in juveniles, we see that they present in a way that's somewhat analogous to ALS. They just have lower motor neuron findings, and they usually have fairly similar symptoms on both sides, and it infects the muscles that are closer to the trunk and not so much further down. And sometimes, but not always, they have a genetic mutation that helps confirm the diagnosis. And then there's another inherited late-onset form of motor neuron disease that we tend to see really just in men, called Kennedy's disease, or X-linked spinal and bulbar muscular atrophy. And that's, again, a lot less common than classic Lou Gehrig's disease. I think some recent literature suggests it's probably a magnitude of maybe, I would say, certainly no more than maybe 1 in 5. So ALS are probably 4 to 5 per 100,000 new cases a year, and Kennedy's disease is more like 1 in 500,000 patients a year. So
wow.
A lot less common. Kennedy's disease, we always want to identify it if we can, because it's not a lethal disease, or it's very rarely lethal. It can run in families, but because it's X-linked recessive, that means that mother would be a carrier, and then only typically men get it, although there are rare reports of women getting mild forms of it. And it progresses in a manner that's much slower than ALS, but it typically involves speech and swallowing, and it can involve the arms and leg muscles, and it can involve the breathing, and it just involves the lower motor neurons. It doesn't involve the upper motor neurons. So that's a disease I always want to be sure about, because it changes prognosis even if I don't have a specific treatment for it. I do want to call attention to one other disease that we always look for, that we always want to be sure about, even though it's technically not a motor neuron disease, and that's a disease called multifocal motor neuropathy. And so that's a disease that is often mistaken for ALS. It's a disease that affects not the neurons, but rather the nerves, and the nerves that are just in the arms and the legs, not in the brain, the nerves that are extending from the spinal motor neurons. And what happens in this disorder is patients can get weak, and then over time they can get some wasting or thinning of the muscle. Usually begins in the arms. It doesn't typically involve swallowing or breathing. But it's hard to identify sometimes. What happens is it causes injury to the coating around the nerve, the myelin, but those findings can be very hard indeed to spot, and the only way to detect them is on the nerve testing, the nerve conduction testing. But that's a disease that may be almost as common, according to some recent literature, as Lou Gehrig's disease itself. So it's one that we absolutely do not want to miss. And I always look for that when I'm seeing a patient with the question of Lou Gehrig's disease, to be very sure I'm not missing that, because it is potentially treatable.
Very good.
Maybe that was something called intravenous immunoglobulin therapy, which is pooled human antibody, which can reverse the weakness to some extent.
Now, are disorders like Guillain-Barré, CIDP, and MS considered related as well?
They're not related, but sometimes, I don't know about Guillain-Barré syndrome mimicking Lou Gehrig's disease. I think that doesn't happen too often, because That's a disease that is very fulminant. It occurs very quickly over the course of a few weeks, where patients start with no symptoms and they become quite weak. That's not something that typically happens in Lou Gehrig's disease. Sometimes patients with Lou Gehrig's disease have sort of a precipitous additional weakness, but over time they continue to incur deficits that sort of that really gradually accumulate. In Guillain-Barré syndrome, they reach their weakest point typically within 2 to 4 weeks, certainly no more than 4 weeks. And they often have a sensory component where they have some changes in sensation, and then the nerve test helps define that disease. There is a chronic form of that disease called chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy, or polyradiculoneuropathy, which is a mouthful.
Sure.
That's also known as CIDP. And there are pure motor forms of CIDP, and so those are rare, very, very rare. And those patients are defined by the nerve conduction study again, because even though they have weakness that's progressing slowly, the manner analogous to ALS, they don't have upper motor neuron signs, and the nerve conduction testing shows, again, injury to the coating around the nerve, the myelin. So that's why that test is so important in trying to be very sure about the question of Lou Gehrig's disease. In my opinion, it's as uncomfortable as it is, it's indispensable. Because you don't want to, I don't want to miss a treatable disorder.
Of course. And lastly, the MS question, are these in the same family?
No, MS is a disease that I guess uncommonly might mimic Lou Gehrig's disease. But the difference is, it presents usually with transient worsening on multiple occasions. Occasionally, it will present with more of a slowly progressive course, but the symptoms are often incompatible or be atypical for Lou Gehrig's disease, such as numbness or changes in vision. So those would make me think of a different disorder, and then the disease is virtually always detected by imaging, by doing an MRI of the brain usually, or if not the brain, the spinal cord. And very virtually always, again, we'll use neuroimaging, typically an MRI, in my evaluation of patients with Lou Gehrig's disease, just to be very sure about that possibility or anything else. Though I have to say, I think clinically, an experienced ALS doctor is probably not going to mistake MS for Lou Gehrig's disease. Probably not, because the symptoms are so different for the most part.
Thank you. We will briefly pause while Amy speaks up.
All right. We just want to tell our listeners to prepare for any questions. We wanted to share the phone number that you need to call in at. The number is 516-590-0362. And if you have a question, please press the number 1 so we can know that you've got one.
Great. Thank you, Amy. Dr. Weiss, thank you for your answers.
Sure.
So far. So we are told that roughly 35,000 people in the U.S. are living with the diagnosis of ALS at any given time. The disorders that you mentioned are, in the most part, much smaller populations. Do we have any idea of comparative numbers for these other disorders?
Yes. Well, the only disorder I think that would be more common than ALS is multiple sclerosis, and I'm not sure I know off the top of my head what the incidence or the number of new cases or prevalence of multiple sclerosis is, but I think it's more substantial than ALS for sure. I can say this about these other more likely mimics, given, or at least things that I think about more carefully, because as I said, I think MS is very unlikely to be mistaken for ALS most of the time. Diseases like spinal bulbar muscular atrophy or Kennedy's disease, the incidence is probably 1 in 500,000 new cases a year, so it's a lot less common. Multifocal motor neuropathy with conduction block, this other really common mimic of ALS, is very common. In fact, some recent literature suggests that it's almost as common as ALS. It's about 1 in 100,000. Mm-hmm. Whereas based on this very recent CDC epidemiologic study, which isn't all that different from previous studies, they looked at the number of existing cases of ALS, and they found there are 4 per 100,000 in the United States. They didn't list the incidence, that is the new cases a year. So multifocal motor neuropathy with conduction block is the most common mimic of ALS, and that is the one that I absolutely don't want to miss because, as I said, that is treatable. Motor CIDP, or CIDP probably in general probably has an incidence that is not terribly different than ALS either, but because most patients have sensory symptoms, they're not going to generally be mistaken for ALS. But there is a pure motor form of CIDP that is so uncommon that I've only seen a few cases of it, and we don't know the incidence of that or the prevalence. That is, how many new cases or how many current cases there are. My guess, it's very, very uncommon.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, on the research of these various disorders, are we learning more about ALS or about these other diseases through cross-disease research?
Well, I think we are with frontotemporal dementia. There's no question about that. We are finding this common connection that we didn't know existed until very recently. So we used to think that Lou Gehrig's disease was a standalone disease, that it was very distinct from other degenerative diseases in that there was only targeting of motor neurons. And clearly that is not true for some patients. So it has gotten us thinking, are there other populations of nerve cells that could potentially be involved? And so there is some preliminary information that sometimes there is some minor component of the sensory nerves that are involved. That hasn't been well corroborated, but there definitely have been a few studies to suggest that. Because I think it's always been hard to understand why just motor neurons are implicated in ALS, so I think this is suggesting that maybe clearly it is not just motor neurons. I'm not sure in terms of treatment if our understanding of these diseases is going to push therapies along necessarily, but I think that it really is helping us to define the pathology better, the sort of principal pathologic features of the disease, which will hopefully lead to treatment. So one thought that I've had, which I think there's been somewhat conflicted evidence, is that these proteins themselves, like TDP-43 in particular, but other proteins like ubiquitin, which deposit in the cytoplasm of neurons, that they actually are in and of themselves damage the neurons, and that the reason why they're there in the first place is because there's impairment of a process by which they're cleared from the cells. So we all have a breakdown of proteins in our nerve cells and other cells, and so what do we do with this? Basically, these breakdown products. It's sort of like when we finish our meal, we have food that we have to get rid of, or next food part, whatever the end result of that meal is. How do we get rid of this these proteins? Well, we do that by a process that's called autophagy. And autophagy is basically, I use the analogy, it's like sort of the garbage disposal of cells. We get rid of constitutive proteins that have that we don't need anymore. They're byproducts of other processes within the cells. And so the question has been whether there's impairment of autophagy in ALS. And there is some evidence for that, but it's somewhat conflicted. So another question then would be, if we can be very sure about autophagy being impaired, and therefore that means that we can't get rid of these proteins that are damaging to the cells, is there a way to fix the problem? Can we promote autophagy? Basically, can we throw some Drano down the pipe and unclog it, as it were? And so there are medications that can do that, and these are medicines that that are often used to suppress inflammation, but primarily they're in the family of anti-organ transplant rejection agents, and one of them is sirolimus, or the other name for it is rapamycin, and there's other ones as well that do very much the same thing. And so that's a question that I wonder about. If we could promote autophagy, could that at least arrest further damage of neurons? And that's something that I haven't put together in a trial, but something I've thought about, that maybe we should think about doing a specific trial to address that. There was a study using there've been other studies using medicines that also promote autophagy. I believe arimoclomol does that to some extent, and lithium. And this lithium didn't help, but maybe another agent would. So I think that is an area of interest that I have that I think needs to be explored in terms of its therapeutic potential.
So excellent segue into your research. You mentioned both areas of interest. Maybe now would be a good time to return to your work on hyperreflexivity.
Right. So a little bit more background about hyperexcitability in ALS. So this has become an area of interest and an area of focus for my therapeutic trials, and in particular mexiletine, which is a study that I designed with the help of with some ideas that were put forth by Bob Brown, who was previously at Massachusetts General Hospital, now at the University of Massachusetts. So he had done some initial studies to show that there is evidence for hyperexcitability of motor neurons, in particular in the mouse model, the most commonly used mouse model for ALS, SOD1 mutant mice. And then he showed that, in particular, mexiletine slowed the rate of decline in these animals and improved survival significantly. So other studies have shown that in these animals, before they're even born, embryonic animals, if you take out their motor neurons and you measure the electrical current in the motor neurons, which is using something called patch clamping, that there's evidence that they're overexcited. And then the reason for that appears that there's too much sodium that's being driven into the cells. So what mexiletine does is it blocks sodium, so it prevents sodium from getting into the cells. And so the big question is, does that cause the damage? We don't know that, but we do know that in this animal model for ALS, that they don't develop signs of the disease until well after they're born, usually a number of weeks after. There is also even some information in patients using a technique that induces movement in the limbs by sending magnetic waves down the motor neurons in the cortex all the way to the spinal cord, then down the spinal motor neurons and their projections to the muscle, that the neurons are overexcited in ALS patients. So these studies have been done in ALS patients because it takes much lower level of the magnetic stimulus to generate a response. So that means that they're very susceptible to the stimulus, that they're overexcited. Unfortunately, we can't really do the same kind of experiments in humans that we can do in this mouse model, and then there's always this question, does the model, how reliable is it to humans, especially sporadic ALS? But nonetheless, there is this information that hyperexcitability occurs, and it occurs not only in the spinal motor neurons but in the cortex based on these kinds of experiments. That was what led to mixiletine, and then there is another study that I'm not the principal investigator for, but I would like to be involved in. It's another Neil study. It's using a drug called retigabine, which is a anti-epileptic. And what retigabine does is it also blocks current going in and out of neurons, and it's blocking specifically potassium current, not sodium. And this study was driven, or was the idea for it, came about because of the other experiments I mentioned, the other studies that I mentioned, but also based on experiments that were done at Harvard Medical School by Kevin Egan, who is a very prominent ALS neuroscientist there, and others. So Kevin has an interest in what are known as inducible pluripotent stem cells. Or iPS cells. And these are cells that are derived from other cells, kinds of cells like skin cells typically, and then they're reprogrammed to form other cells, and in the case of what Kevin's doing, motor neurons. So he actually took skin cells from patients with familial ALS with SOD1 mutations, and then he reprogrammed them to make them into motor neuron cells in culture. And then he did very similar kind of experiments of what I mentioned earlier in the SOD1 mice, where he did where he had somebody help him probably, micro patch clamping. And again, he showed evidence for hyperexcitability that he could block with retigabine. And I think that was he looked at other medications, but that was the one that he found was most helpful. And that is an FDA-approved drug, so that it makes it easier to do studies and potentially bring the drug, get the drug to patients if we already have a drug that's on the market. So that's what led to this study that's about to start. I don't know when it's going to start, and we hope to be a part of it. It's a Neil-sponsored study, but it's addressing the exact same potential so-called pathogenic mechanism for ALS, that is hyperexcitability leading to damage to the neurons, both the upper and lower motor neurons. And then the question is, can we arrest or slow the disease down by preventing that from continuing to happen with these medications?
Wonderful, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that as it comes up, and we will forward that on through our website. On the study you are leading with mixoletine, is that a study, you mentioned that it's well underway, are you finished recruiting, or how can we help?
So we're finished recruiting, and we should have our last patient through the study, that is, get to the last visit by the middle of September. We hope to have some preliminary results to report at the Northeast ALS Consortium meeting in late October. And then if not, then maybe one of the other upcoming meetings, like the Packard Center meeting, which is an ALS meeting at Johns Hopkins, sponsored by Johns Hopkins University, and then or the American Academy of Neurology meeting, which is usually in April. And so that's a 60, it's a phase two study, which means it's not a huge study, because, and there aren't, there real, there isn't, I don't think there are any other studies that are phase three right now for ALS, but it's 60 subject study, 10 centers, all sponsored, all NEALS sites, Northeast ALS Consortium sites. And so it's going well. We haven't had any major safety issues at all. So we're learning. We've learned that much, that the drug is fairly safe. Now the question is, can we show benefit in slowing the disease? The other parameter that we're measuring is, because unfortunately a lot of studies, clinical trials in ALS have not been successful in slowing the disease down. One other goal is, even if it doesn't do that, and we're still optimistic that it will, and that we will need to probably do a bigger study to very much prove that. But the other goal is to see if it has an effect on muscle cramping. So muscle cramping, as I'm sure a lot of listeners are aware, is a very big problem in many ALS patients, and there isn't great medication for it. And the reason why the cramping occurs, or we believe it, this is the reason, is because there are when the neurons die, the spinal motor neurons die, and the nerve processes degenerate, then other neurons and their nerve processes can temporarily take their place. And then when they do take their place and they send little newly formed branches to the muscle that's lost its nerve supply, what happens is those branches are, because they're not mature, they take a while to mature, and sometimes they never do, they're, again, overexcited, and that's what leads to the cramping. And so, again, the thought is that if we suppress that hyperexcitability, that we could have, that could potentially benefit patients who have cramping as well. So that's another part of the study, to see if it improves muscle cramping in our patients. And we're hopeful that that will be the case as well.
Thank you. We will now begin. We'll prepare for our last question and invite listeners to call in, Amy.
Yeah, the phone number for that is 516-590-0362. I'm going to give that one more time. It's 516-590-0362. And please, please press number 1 if you have a question so we know.
Great. While listeners dial in, I want to ask Dr. Weiss, what is the greatest opportunity in your mind for our listeners to get involved in ALS research?
Well, it depends on how you mean. So obviously, this is ALS research. We're always looking for sources of funding. So if there are contributions, there's some very useful organizations, or there are some organizations that I think could really use that money. Muscular Dystrophy Association, they have unfortunately had some financial issues, which has made it really challenging for them to fund any clinical trials or any research recently. So they're in great need of any support. There's also an organization called the ALS Therapy Development Institute, which is run by a very prominent neuroscientist, Steve Perrin. And his goal is to find what's called translational research, which is looking at this problem not necessarily looking at the cause of ALS, but trying to establish a treatment in the laboratory, a potential treatment, and then taking it with usually with the help of the Northeast ALS Consortium to the patient, or at least into a clinical trial. It's becoming a conduit for potential therapeutics. So I'm sure that that's another organization that would benefit from any contributions. And then probably the ALS Association as well. But it doesn't have to be financial contributions. There are always events that are important for raising money that I think having a presence would be of help. Like there are always there are walkathons. There's an ALS Association has a walkathon coming up, I believe. I don't remember the date. And obviously patients can't do it with ALS, may not be able to walk, but just having their being present, I think, it can show to the lay public the seriousness of this disease, so that they become involved and potentially they find a way to help. We can find another way to help finance some of these research projects, which are underfinanced because this is really still considered to be an orphan disease, and that means that there isn't a lot of funding coming from the NIH. Directed towards ALS research, unfortunately. Hopefully that will change, but I don't know when at this point.
Thank you. We are here at ALS Crowd Radio. We're huge fans of the MDA and ALS TDI and the association. I'm grateful you mentioned them. With that, we will prepare to go to the phone lines. We will take our first caller. Caller 1, you're on the air with Dr. Michael Weiss.
Hello.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. I want to go back to the MMN diagnosis.
Yeah.
I am wondering, what is the testing for MMN? And is it? I know with a lot of tests, there's false positives, false negatives. There's no sure thing. Also along with that, with IVIG treatment, how long do you normally give the treatment before you decide if it's working or not, or what's the criteria to know if it's working? And then another question is, why isn't IVIG treatment being used for Lou Gehrig's? And let me preface that by saying I've been given IVIG treatment. I noticed a difference in how I felt, fatigue, less fasciculations, more dexterity. But oddly, my doctor said, no, it's all in your head, no more.
So those are great questions, and they do come up a lot. My feeling is, there actually have been some studies, small studies, in just ALS patients alone with IVIG that have not clearly shown benefit, but if there's any consideration of the diagnosis of multifocal motor neuropathy, I always do give patients a treatment trial if their insurance will allow. That's always a struggle. Multifocal motor neuropathy with conduction block is defined by the electrophysiology, the nerve conduction testing, showing conduction block, which is an area along the course of the nerve where we're stimulating the motor nerve to the muscle, where there is a block in the signal because of loss of the coating or the myelin. Now, there are patients for whom that is a challenge to see, or maybe they don't meet all the formal criteria that have been put forth by different different organizations. The things that I always think about is they cannot have upper motor neuron signs. So multifocal motor neuropathy patients should not have jumpy reflexes or increased muscle tone. If that's the case, I know they don't have it. The antibody test there's an antibody test for multifocal motor neuropathy that is helpful, but it's not nearly as sensitive as we would like. It only has a sensitivity of about 40%, and that is an antibody to something called GM1. Which is a complex sugar that's present on nerves. We used to think it was very sensitive, but recent studies suggest it's not. And occasionally it can even be weakly positive in ALS patients. So if that test were to come back more than just weakly positive, for sure, I think that's a rationale for using IVIG. But it's really other things that there's a clinical features of the multifocal motor neuropathy. They cannot have upper motor neuron signs. They shouldn't have any trouble swallowing or chewing. They don't typically have breathing issues. So otherwise, sometimes it is hard to know for sure. And sometimes I'll just treat. And you asked, what would I treat with? What would be my protocol? I use the protocol I use is similar to what I use for CIDP patients, which was pretty well defined based on a IVIG study done in CIDP called the ICE study. And basically, I do an induction course where I'm giving patients sort of a double dose, 2 grams per kilogram body weight is the dose I give them, and then every 3 weeks I give them 1 gram per kilogram body weight for 3 times, and what I measure, because there isn't any consensus on this, what I'm measuring is I'm assessing individual muscle groups using something called manual muscle testing. I'm just testing the muscles and a scale called the Medical Research Council scale, which is what neurologists use, MRC scale. And what I use as my criteria is that patients have to have an improvement of at least 2 muscles by at least 1 grade. This is just me, so there's no consensus for this. And then I measure their grip strength with a device called a dynamometer. And some other neurologists actually use dynamometry to measure other individual muscles. And so what I'm looking for is at least a 20% increase, because I'm not looking for improvement of fatigue. Unfortunately, there's no way to really measure that. And I'm not looking for improvement of muscle twitching, because muscle twitching or fasciculations in ALS vary all the time. They come and go. They don't correlate well with the disease. And it's just not, unfortunately, it's not going to help me too much. But that's just the way I do it. Now, I don't know if what other neurologists use as their criteria, but that's just what I've always used. But if when in doubt, though, I will always give patients a treatment trial. I hope I answered your question.
No, you did. My other I could keep going, but my other question is, you said on the nerve conduction test that you do see a depletion of the myelin. Is that, and that's a thing with MMN because of nerve conduction blockage. I'm wondering if that is also true in ALS patients.
No, so that is the distinguishing feature. So the myelin is not being damaged in ALS. So ALS
and that is only found...
What were you going to ask?
I was going to say, and that is only found with the use of a nerve conduction test?
Yes. Regrettably, the other than the clinical presentation, of course, which is somewhat challenging in distinguishing from motor neuron disease, ALS, it's really the nerve conduction testing.
Mm-hmm.
And what distinguishes ALS, MMN from ALS, is the conduction block.
Okay.
That is absolutely required for a definitive diagnosis of MMN.
All right. I have one more question.
Sure.
What do you tell patients that, you know, no one wants this diagnosis, and you want to keep researching and finding things that can help you, but sometimes it's hard for a patient to find a doctor who's proactive or will help them because they think, you know what, just use the time you have left to do something great with your life or whatever. What advice can you give to a patient that really does want to keep searching out a way that they can improve this disease, they're living with this disease, and hopefully finding that it's not this disease?
Well, I think that, I certainly try my best to be open-minded to what patients ask me about, but my goal is also not to expose them to something that's going to potentially decrease their survival. And that's always, I know the thought is, well, what do I have to probably, I don't have this disease, but I've talked to enough patients. What do I have to lose? I guess it depends also on how fast the disease is progressing. And in some patients, it doesn't progress that quickly. And so the idea of subjecting them to an unconventional therapy that could potentially kill them is really, for me, still somewhat unpalatable. And that happens sometimes. But then there are other therapies where I tell patients I don't know if this is going to help. There's just no evidence one way or the other. I'd like there to be some kind of a rationale for doing it, like that it's an antioxidant, for instance, and it's therefore it's blocking the accumulation. It's getting rid of oxygen-free radicals, and so there are protocols that are being used by patients, and I'm not going to go into detail, but that where that is the case, and I tell them, I don't know. I don't know if it's helping. I don't think there's any harm to doing this. I'm not going to have a problem with you doing this if you want, and I'm okay with that. So it really depends on what they find out and what they research and what they ask me about, whether I'm okay or not. There is a very useful resource which if you were to read it, you may agree or not agree with the information, but there's something known as ALS Untangled. And I don't know if you know about this. So ALS Untangled is I guess it's a collaborative editorial. I don't know how else to describe it. Basically, it's an investigation of an alternative therapy for which there really isn't any, hasn't been a real true clinical trial, nothing published on the National Library of Medicine website. And it's run by by Richard Bedlick, who is the director of the ALS Center at Duke University. So what he does is he gets the opinion of all these ALS neurologists, or I don't know if it has to be neurologists, but usually neurologists, at ALS centers, usually academic centers throughout the United States, about alternative therapies and their utility or lack of utility. Should they be even studied? Or is there really no good scientific rationale, and are they potentially harmful? And of course, this is the opinion of himself and all of us who participate. But nonetheless, you might find that useful. And so, I don't know the exact website, but it's if you put in ALS Untangled, it will take you right to them. And then there are a multiple number of publications addressing specific topics. I think that Richard would be, Rick, would be open to the idea of having some topics be patient-driven, even, like you wanted to know.
Yeah.
Would he give you some information about it? I think that makes sense. If patients really want to know, then why don't we see if we think it's reasonable or not, as getting this consensus from ALS neurologists. There have been a number of these publications, and they're all open access, but they're also published on in a journal called ALS and Other Motor Neuron. ALS Frontotemporal Dementia and Other Motor Neuron Disorders is the name of the journal, which is the primary ALS journal.
Thank you. Thanks for giving me your time. This has been a really great interview.
I'm glad to hear it.
And thank you, caller, for pushing us, and Dr. Weiss for keeping us abreast of the tough issues. We have time for one more caller. We'll go to caller two now. You are on the air with Dr. Michael Weiss.
Hello?
Hello, caller two.
Hello? Hello?
Caller two. It looks like we have just lost, maybe caller two, are you there? The number ending in 1034.
Go ahead with your question.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Yes, you are on.
Oh, yes, hi. I have a question. Can you give us some perspective and help us understand about how many ALS specialists are worldwide that are maybe principal investigators doing active research?
Well, if you're talking about ACT, so there are a lot of M. So I think the place to start is that there are a number of ALS centers throughout the United States that are either sponsored by the ALS Association and or the MDA, and they have specific expertise in ALS. I believe that the number of – the University of Washington, we're an MDA ALS center, and I believe there are something like 35 centers throughout the United States. Probably every center has a few ALS neurologists, so if that gives you some perspective. And then the ALS Association, I imagine, has similar numbers, maybe more. What I find is that in most – big cities where there's an MDA ALS center, there's probably equal numbers of ALS association clinics. Mm-hmm. And of those groups of neurologists, probably most of them are doing clinical trials, but they may not be the principal investigator. They may not be creating their own trial, but they might be helping to implement it as a site. So of the number of trials that are going on in the United States right now, most of them are being conducted through the Northeast ALS Consortium, which is basically a group of physicians that are centered primarily at the Massachusetts General Hospital under the auspices of Dr. Merit Sikovic, who was on this program earlier, and
yeah.
organization. Is they basically run, I would say, two-thirds of the ALS studies in the United States right now, and I believe there are probably about 12 or 13 studies going on right now, and at least two-thirds of them are sponsored by the Northeast ALS Consortium. So my mixolitine study is sponsored by the Northeast ALS Consortium. But then in Europe, I don't know what the infrastructure is for doing studies. There are also basic scientists at a number of institutions who have a real focus on ALS, and they aren't necessarily doing clinical trials. And there are groups at Johns Hopkins Hospital and University of Massachusetts and Massachusetts General Hospital, and there are places along the West Coast like Bob Ballow's group down at Cedars-Sinai and Bob Barrow at – or sorry, Bob – oh. I'm blanking on his name. Sorry, Bob Bowser at the Barrow in Arizona. So those are among the focal points for ALS neuroscience research. But if you're going to ask, and I don't know if I can give you a specific number about how many doctors are involved in research, but it's a fair number of neurologists, or they've taken a very strong interest to understanding the disease and then trying to do trials. Do we want it to be more? Sure, we do. We want more doctors to be involved in this disease and trying to treat it. And I think the largest group of doctors probably at the Massachusetts General Hospital right now, and they probably about eight neurologists there who've been doing trials or have an interest in ALS research. I'm not sure I answered your question, but I think that's about the closest I can get.
Oh, no, you did. No, I just wanted to get some perspective. And I had another question for you. With
sure.
the mortality rate of ALS, it seems like instead of – I know a lot of times in scientific research it's very incremental. And I think mm-hmm. in ALS, instead of base hits, you want really big swings at the plate. So in your opinion, what elements need to be in place for more aggressive or bigger risk-taking, I guess you would say, to really make it leap forward?
Well, that's a great question. So I think that we have to just start thinking outside the box more than we ever have and take new approaches that we haven't taken before. But it's also a question of study design. So unfortunately, there have been a number of studies that have not shown benefit ultimately. Maybe in smaller studies they have. And then there was this very big study that was done a couple years ago, sponsored by Biogen, the dexpramipaxel study. And I believe that was the largest study done, clinical trial ever done in ALS. It was a multinational study. I forgot the exact number of patients, but there were probably over 80 centers. We were part of that study. And unfortunately, and it turned out that even after the fairly robust and surprising benefit from the type from the smaller phase 2 study, which showed the drug was slowing decline and it was lowering or decreasing the rate of decline of the in regard to breathing parameters, forced vital capacity, and changes on the ALS functional rating scale score, which is a very important questionnaire of activities of daily living that ALS patients we have them fill it out in our clinic. Pretty straightforward questionnaire, but very important parameter that we can quantify. That even though it shows improvement or slowing of the rate of decline of those functions in the phase 2 study, a smaller study, phase 3 study was negative. And it cost the drug company $75 million. And no matter what they are, and I don't think they're turning their back on ALS, but the idea of doing another big trial like that that's going to cost that much money that will not lead and quite frankly, any additional revenue for the drug company is going to be unpalatable for some of these drug companies. So then the question in my mind is, should we be looking at other kinds of study designs that would really answer this question at least quicker? And there was a study that was done recently that tried to do that. It was the tamoxifen creatine study, where there were two drugs that had shown benefit mostly in preclinical animal models, and the idea being, we're going to compare these two potential drugs, and then we're going to take whichever drug does better, assuming one does, to a bigger study. That way, we're sort of hedging our bets, and I think that is a very unique way to look at clinical trial design. That might be a way to move things forward more quickly, without wasting time on drugs that are just not going to work, even though they showed benefit in the ALS mice. And so I think that might be that might continue to be a good approach to this. I also think that we probably, unfortunately, because it's so much cheaper, we probably have to do. If we have a positive phase 2 trial, I think it has, in my opinion, we have to replicate the phase 2 trial before we do a big phase 3. That way that we won't scare off drug companies that are willing to invest a lot of money, and then we've sort of hedged our bets again by showing that we've corroborated the results on two different occasions. I mean, I guess it could even be done in parallel if that were possible. Except then you wouldn't know if either study was going to be positive. So if they're short studies and one shows benefit, it makes sense to me just repeat the study, see if it shows benefit again, and then do a phase 3 study if a drug company is willing to pay for it. So that's kind of my thoughts about drug trials.
And as a follow-up to that, are there any indications that there's maybe low-hanging fruit with some existing drugs that are maybe used in other diseases that might be applicable that you could test in ALS? I would think that would be a less expensive, more rapid type option.
Absolutely. That's what we're all hoping to do. That's why I picked mexiletine as a drug, because it's already FDA approved for, I didn't mention this earlier, it's a cardiac antiarrhythmic agent. That's not, the cardiologists don't use it very much because it's not very effective, but it's an older drug. So that's one. And then retigabine is already the other trial I mentioned that's going to start relatively soon. That's another one that's already FDA approved for treating epilepsy. And then tamoxifen, creatine, both of those drugs, tamoxifen is an anti-hormonal therapy for breast cancer, and then creatine is just over-the-counter supplement. But creatine did not work, though. It doesn't seem to be beneficial. So we are trying to do that because I think as clinical trialists in ALS, we recognize how hard it is to start with a novel drug. Unfortunately, though, if we could get a smart pharmacologist to help us, sometime, you know, that may also, you know, I don't think we can ignore that possibility that we need to come up with a new drug that is not out there. We kind of have to do both because we haven't found a drug that's already existing that clearly slows the disease down significantly. But you're right, that's easier to do those studies for sure if the drug's already out there.
Well, it seems like you're working all angles. So thank you, Dr. White, so much for taking my call and for the show.
You're very welcome.
And thank you, caller, for those questions. We are now at the end of our call, and I would, Dr. Weiss, anything else you would like to mention before we wrap up?
I'd just like to say that for those patients out there, you know, there are definitely a lot of neurologists out there who would like nothing more to see an end to this disease or some viable treatment. We're on your side. We're going to continue to be on your side, and I have no doubt we're going to find a better way to treat this disease sometime in the near future. And so I don't want you to give up hope, because that's one thing that I'm convinced there is somewhere down the road. I don't know when, but I'm sure of it.
All right. When you figure out when, please come back on this show.
Seth, you're going to be the first to know. Well, maybe you'll be the first to know. You'll be one of the first to know.
All right. Thank you for that. And thank you for your not only time, but your dedication to this community.
I am happy to continue to help any way I can.
Excellent. For our listeners, a full transcript of this interview will be available within the week and posted to our website. Thank you to Dr. Michael Weiss, and we look forward to solving this disease. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.